Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. We're going to continue looking at books that I've produced and narrated. This week, we'll start looking at the two books I produced for author Michael Miller. These two books revolve around a young fellow we meet as a boy in book one, and then meet as a young man in book two. His claim to fame? He possesses an extra lobe in his brain. This addition to his anatomy allows him to read the subconscious thoughts of those around him, and as you might expect, this creates problems for the boy and opportunities for the adult. Author Michael Miller says that he remembers when street snowbanks were 7 feet or more, with road sounds muffled by blistering winter, snow forts and tunnels, sledding and ice skating were his main interests at an early age, until television, computer chips, and literary artists changed our world. As a teen, becoming fascinated by mysteries, science fiction, and technology, events like Woodstock, 60s rock, space launches, and the Vietnam War molded him in ways he better understands years later. Upon lengthy fine-tuning by the real world of military and corporate establishments, his vivid experiences are revealed in science fiction novels that stir emotions hiding beneath the surface. This week, we'll look at his first book in this series, The Sixth Lobe, a mixture of science fiction and adventure and intrigue. But let's start out by meeting our boy, Danny. As Danny Wilson daydreams, leaning against a second-story bedroom window, his face twists in anguish while cupping palms over his ears. Eyelids closed tightly, deflecting a crescendo of pain invading his head. It is the first time in recent days the strange experience has occurred early in the morning, normally a busy time preparing for the approaching school day. Agony from the excruciating torment pressing on his brain lasts briefly, a good deal less severe than last night, he thanks the Lord. Increasingly fearing his sprouting affliction, the spirited youth contemplates death and its impact. Did most people think terrible things before dying? Would he feel pain after it was over? What did over mean? Would grandparents take care of him in the hereafter until reunited with mom and dad? The boy searches his memory for clues, but questions go unanswered. What did he know about life after death? Muddled and unclear facts push him to doubt religious leanings. Where is heaven? He softly whispers, looking upward through the dripping window pane. Did God have angels watching over him, as his favorite Sunday school teacher preached? How would he know if the Maker heard his prayers? Please, Lord, don't forget me. Danny prays aloud, cautiously presuming God is occupied in faraway places where children do not have enough food, love, and toys. These and other related ideas dance on his brain until a familiar resonant voice shatters his trance-like state. Danny, the commanding voice yells, I want your bed made before coming downstairs. Standing at the bottom of the stairs, leaning against a sloping banister, Jenny Wilson waits for her son's response. As stillness above continues, she speaks more boisterously. Did you hear me, young man? The mother clamors menacingly, contemplating her decision to stop at one child. Maybe two rugrats would be less spoiled. Aw, jeez, Ma, the youngster gripes fruitlessly. Although the argument had lost momentum long ago, Danny ignores his better judgment. I'll be late for my bus again, he shouts back, knowing the excuse is lame and beyond hope. I'll take that risk. Now get a move on, Buster. I'll count to three and you better be moving, his mother threatens with tones a bit more ferocious. One, two, Jenny counts slowly with spirally volume, as always avoiding the fateful and dreaded number three. Two and a half, 2¾. Jenny prays she never reaches number 3, since it will require an appropriate punishment, one undefined so far.
Okay, okay, I'm coming, he yells, also fearing to hear number 3,
and hoping never suffering what must be dreadful consequences.
Geez, Louise, don't have a cow, he grumbles with declining volume.
Danny stuffs several books in a backpack, unevenly flings the bed's blue-checkered quilt over the lower bunk, yanks a large wad of grayish bubblegum off his nightstand, then bounces downstairs, hitting every third step. Someday, maybe his 10th birthday, he'd attempt 4 steps at a crack. Dan loathes the thought of being late for the school bus, especially when a certain cranky old battle axe is manning the wheel. The lad wonders what Mrs. Monster is thinking today, especially since it is damp and drizzling, and a reliable indicator of the bus driver's fermented disposition. After inhaling a small bowl of oatmeal and piece of toast washed down with a tall glass of milk, Danny says bye to father, pecks mother's awaiting cheek, then bolts out the kitchen door with reckless abandon. Negotiating neighborhood bicycles, balls, and hedges, he speeds around the street corner for the final leg of his weekday excursion, splashing as many puddles as possible, though carefully avoiding cracks in the sidewalk that might yield unidentified misfortunes. As expected, Danny draws rave reviews from the ornery female driver while pushing his way toward the rear of what he and friends called the banana wagon. His heavy backpack, crammed with books and lunch, knocks against other half-alert children while searching for an open spot as far from the driver as physically possible. Maybe, he hopes, the old bag, over 30 no doubt, had a good night loaded with pleasant dreams unlike yesterday. Though Danny wants her thoughts to be friendly, Mrs. Monster reprimands him as he shuffles to the back of the bus. After plunking down on the last vinyl bench seat, the driver catches the youngster's stern look and pursed lips through a large rectangular mirror mounted above her head. After a loud snort, the tempered woman slams the bus into gear and speeds away. 9 years young, Daniel David Wilson is a youngster most neighbors would label a typical fourth grader, middle of the road from most perspectives. Doing his utmost, upholding solid American tradition, he hides dirty clothes beneath the bunk bed rather than stuff them in a hamper 5 feet away, skips pages in school reading assignments, and plays his stereo loud enough to benefit the entire neighborhood. Guided by God-fearing, middle-class, tax-paying nurturers, Fred and Jenny, his behavior and attitudes are best summarized as a modern cross-section of Dennis the Menace and Beaver Cleaver meshed into one. He's happy, but not excessive, and mischievous, but not troublesome. Danny's wallflower suburban haven, providing security and warmth, is a nondescript 1,800 square feet, two-story, high-peak red-bricked home located in an often dreary Midwestern town on the shores of Lake Michigan. About 3:30, depending on weather, traffic, and driver disposition, Danny and pals explode off the banana wagon with informal plans to play an array of games including baseball, football, hide-and-seek, kick-the-can, bicycle gauntlet, tree assault, and G.I. Joe. More than likely, before dragging in for supper around 5:30 or 6, there's often be one or more little warriors wimping or limping home to sympathetic mamas bearing minor abrasions, bruises, bloody noses, and other character-building afflictions. Despite the horrors of their wounds, sometimes bad enough to deserve special desserts or weekday respites at home, they reappear the next day, late afternoon, if timed properly, like new, ready to experience more of what life would offer. On those days, convincing the warden they were fit enough to play outside, despite missing school, was a formidable challenge needing occasional practice. Children like Danny, with preciously short memories for depressing thoughts and worries, find it easy shaking the worrisome nuances adults stumble over until headaches develop. On luckier days, fire engines, police cars, or ice cream trucks interrupt the gang's gaiety with additional exhilaration. In time, Danny's parents become concerned about his headaches and take him to a specialist. Jane takes an immediate interest in Danny and in his welfare. Jane Brown is especially appreciative and mindful of Dan's kind-hearted nature, particularly involving his mother's protection. Quite perceptive at a youthful age, Danny reserves the most horrifying images for his father in Jane Brown, rationalizing that his mother cannot bear such needless burdens. Danny feels relief after sharing the worst mental invasions and images with Bigfoot, a woman slight in stature, but one with exceptional inner strength and stamina. Lifting tons of worry from heavy shoulders, Fred finds belated comfort in relating Vietnam ordeals to Danny, though unable hiding the most graphic details of combat and brutality. Tears roll frequently as verbalizations and visualizations of Fred's combat experiences surface. Considerable time elapses before Fred can deal with the fact that his son knows so much about suffering and pain. Though Jenny presses for explicit details of their conversations, Fred conveniently skips the more shocking stories. Only Danny and Jane are privy. Brown rearranges schedules, accommodating the times when she and Danny can meet and relate one-on-one without interruption. The case begins consuming her every waking moment. Sympathetic, generous, and wealthy, Jane gradually phases out other clients, focusing her complete attention on Danny. Lectures and world tours, once a normal and desirable lifestyle, are canceled or put on hold. Carefully developed notes and recordings, many preserved on cassettes and camcorder tapes, are organized and filed in a converted war room on the third floor. Above the doorway hangs a sign providing constant reminder of her mission, saying, "Success or failure, it's a choice." The message, arguably unnecessary and heroic, aptly fits Danny's perilous predicament in Jane's professional perspective. Finding the pessimistic sign increasingly burdensome, she later attaches an appropriate response inside the room to see upon exiting the room. Countering it reads, "Up for the challenge." A third tasteful banner, representing a quotation from General Patton, hangs in her master bathroom. Success is measured by how high you bounce after hitting bottom. Someday, she plans writing her story for future generations to share. More like Danny Wilson might come along and need help long after Father Time has staked eternal claims to Bigfoot and Duke. Danny, finally 10 years young, 10 and a half, he'd say, gradually shares more incredible stories as his sixth lobe develops stronger brain connections. Weight of his piling bombshells bear heavily on Brown, with stress loads growing beyond her imagination and desires. Although time with Nick relieves much of her tension, Jane's conscience soon overshadows her sense of duty to the profession rigidly based on privacy and secrecy. Much to her chagrin, she discovers that self-analysis, often in hot baths or during lengthy jogs, helps more than romps in the hay with Nick, a fact she attributes laughingly to mind over matter. Dealing with a growing concern that people, many of which few would suspect, have the potential for dark evil as well as goodness, is perplexing. The substitute physician Danny had visited, Dr. Parsons, indeed killed his patient, Jane believes grudgingly. Parsons' wedding to the victim's wife several months later confirms as much.
How could it be a coincidence? The animal had gotten away with murder Jane half buries in her mind. The reminder of it puts her stomach in knots. Contented having contained Dan's condition, she wonders how many secrets a body could absorb before bursting at the seams. Should she share any of these new burdens with Nicholas? Taking advantage of her notoriety, experiments help reinforce Danny's expanding powers. With him out of view and under the guise of research, Jane arranges meetings and interviews of celebrities, politicians, and social acquaintances. If real motives were known, there would be hell to pay, endangering her career and quite possibly her life. She knows all too well how lofty people react when personal lives are laundered. Risks, though high, seem appropriate. She has to prepare her naive patient for the adult and cruel world that will recklessly exploit nature's gift. That much is certain. Jane spends long hours encoding Danny's files in case of theft or other unanticipated developments. Aliases employed shield reputations. She is engrossed by details Danny conveys, often as if discussing Disney cartoon characters or the weather. The emerging pattern of casual aloofness when relating events begins worrying her. Would Duke recognize and be able to deal with reality when confronted head-on? No matter, Jane resolves privately. She'd be there, seeing him through emergencies and inevitable ordeals, leaving little to amateur parents. Records grow rapidly as mental images pour through Danny's increasingly functional sixth lobe and into Jane's portfolio of webbed data. If nothing else, by being fully exposed, Danny will be less affected by the growing varieties of hatred, misery, and suffering devised by man. Brown is increasingly resolved, letting Danny experience many evils, yet be emotionally prepared to decide, filter, then accept what is wholesome, real, and good. As months pass, Danny develops use of his special lobe, not unlike other parts of his brain, a power boosting his inner strength and confidence.
But Jane is not the only one interested in Danny. There are two other parties who see potential in him. Each seeks to advance their own agenda.
John Carmine Sr. folds his usual morning newspaper into a tight roll and hurls it at his son. From his wheelchair, the retired family boss laid the wood to his replacement as best he could manage.
"What's the matter with you, Johnny? Are you off your freaking rocker?"
"What are you moaning about, old man?" the son gripes.
"Old man, I'd kick your butt right now if I could stand up. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Why do we need a psychic, especially a child?"
"I'm heading this family now, and don't forget it, Pop. I answer to no one, not even to you anymore."
"If you get crazy, you'll have the other families down on us like ugly on eggs. You think they want this kind of publicity? I put a lot of effort keeping low profiles. Now you're screwing it up."
"Senile old fart."
"You're a butthole," the old man barks. "And a stupid one, too. And I'm not senile. Mine's sharp as ever."
"Why are you always ragging? Just because you're my old man, you think I'm supposed to cater to your every whim? Why don't you stay in Florida with the other has-beens?"
"I don't butt in unless it is needed,"
the father grouses, imperious to criticism.
"How can you be so ignorant? Psychic, for Pete's sake. Okay, maybe I do meddle, but I was top dog in this family years before you had teeth. Broke a lot of knees getting us this far. Now you're messing up everything with these harebrained schemes."
"Harebrained, huh? You should talk. Remember the time you whacked the stool pigeon inside the jail that was inside the stinking fifth precinct? Talk about being a loon."
The son chortled.
"You weren't lucky getting out of there."
"Lucky, my butt. That took balls. Now tell me why we need a psychic."
"Not just any psychic, Pa. The kid's for real, not some silly crystal ball freak of Vegas act. Imagine if we could predict the stock market, gold prices, and what competition's thinking. Picture Fat Louis' face when I stiff him," John Jr. explains, referring to a local competitor.
"Nobody can do all that, especially a kid. You've been misled as usual,
the Elder Carmine warns, waving a hand reinforcing his point.
I have it on good authority that you're wrong, old man.
Who's considered good authority?
Carmine Sr. says disdainfully.
Police, for one,
Junior replies boastfully.
Fuzz don't know crap and never did. They're bigger fools than you.
Oh, yeah? Then why did his kid disappear? And how come the cops suddenly arrive at this idiot reporter's apartment right when my boys are about to whack him? Tell me that, Einstein. Paper says a neighbor called because of strange sounds from the next apartment. What do you expect in a cheap dump when you're beating the crap out of someone?
Paper's lying, I tell you. This kid's special. I've heard his eyes roll back into his head when he gets these visions. Don't tell me that doesn't mean something.
It means the kid's probably anemic or has convulsions. I'm no doctor, but rolling eyes doesn't prove crap.
Okay, then. How do you explain these sudden breakthroughs in murder cases? Informants tell me they got a man who killed a cop in Charlotte 10 years ago. Awful lot of good police work in Racine lately.
What else do you know?
The father asked, thinking he'd spoken too harshly and wondering if the son is on to something unique.
We're listening to excerpts from Michael Miller's book, The Sixth Lobe. Let's see who else might be interested in Danny.
The Wilsons are startled as the tall stranger, donning a long, dark trench coat, enters ahead of Sikorsky, their minds racing to various conclusions. Moving into the living room to accommodate 5 people, Sikorsky orders the agent to sit. Claims he works for Uncle Sam, Sikorsky begins telling the Wilsons. Says his name's Ricks. Let's see identification. No problem. Can I reach into my pocket? He asks, placing a tight-fitting pair of gloves on his lap. His question worries the Wilsons, who wonder why the lanky stranger needs permission. Let's see it, Sikorsky answers curtly, as Fred and Jenny suddenly feel the tension. Sikorsky examines his wallet, then passes it to Fred. What's NPSS? Fred asks, holding the plastic card. Never heard of it.
National Protection and Security Service, Mr. Wilson. We specialize in guardianship of special assets.
I see, Fred nods.
Got an agency in Washington for everything. No wonder the budget's out of whack.
May I continue explaining? Ricks follows, not amused by Fred's nervous and stumbling attempt at humor.
Downtown sent him here, so I guess it is all right, Sikorsky addresses the Wilson.
Up to you whether he stays, he continues, pressuring the agent, implying he'd toss Ricks out if needed.
We don't know you from Adam, Mr. Ricks. Why should we trust you, a complete stranger?
Fred reasons correctly. Delaying a response, the agent rises slowly, then moves cautiously to a central location. There he clears his throat and considers an appropriate answer, promising himself to offer minimal information as mind races through rehearsed scenarios.
The agency I represent requires top-level clearance, tougher standards than any in the world, including the CIA. Very few people know anything about us, partly for reasons of security, but more importantly to maintain low profiles for the assets we're entrusted. You'd be surprised knowing how many people receive our services, sometimes without their knowledge. You, Danny, are a special situation.
He smiles, studying the boy's face, looking for special identifying marks to confirm identity.
What do you want? Fred chimes. And skip the bureaucratic runaround. You'd be surprised to know how many people don't trust guys like you.
Agent Ricks looks to Sikorsky for help that fails arriving. Choosing the better part of valor, he decides not to pit himself against the detective whose popularity is obvious. Description of events outside would be used only if needed. Though Sikorsky could have verified his identity, he chooses to make the agent work a little harder.
Right, Mr. Wilson, and I'd like telling you more about NPSS, but I'm not authorized to release any more information. I can say, however, that our agency is very good at what we do. I personally have guarded many famous people.
Why, Danny, Fred says irritably. He isn't famous. Mr. Wilson, you're putting me in a difficult situation. Allow me to finish explaining why you need us, then I'll answer questions I'm authorized to address. You know the expression, loose lips sink ships? Loose lips? You haven't told us a damn thing. Thank you. Please be seated, Mr. Wilson. Rick waits as Fred slowly reseats himself. As I was saying, I'm authorized to guarantee your family's safety for as long as necessary. Folks in your situation have little hope due to the nature of certain citizens who feel compelled to control events and people. What we offer are new lives and environments by completely erasing traces of your current existence. Sounds like a witness protection program, Fred argues convincingly. Sounds like a nightmare, Jenny adds glumly. Wipe out our existence? What about friends and family? Rick ignores Jenny's emotional outburst, instead selecting Fred's question that is more easily addressed. Danny's not a witness in a crime, ma'am. Plus, witness protection is way down the scale from the life you'll receive with our agency. We go first class with our clients, ma'am. Clients, Fred gripes. What do we have to do for all this special kindness, Mr. Ricks? Fred's horrible stock market experiences seem to shade his judgment in every aspect of life. Any deal too good to be true was indeed too good to be true. Sounds too good to be true, he echoes. All we expect is cooperation, Fred explains calmly. Simple as that. Cooperation, Fred asks. From Danny? Of course. But what kind of cooperation? Jenny says, applying herself to the conversation. Our government has needs that, if met, can produce significant results. Someone important thinks Danny fits those needs. There you go again, Ricks, talking, but not telling us a damn thing, Fred grouses. Speak English, man. Ricks chuckles, then laughs. You're right, Mr. Wilson. I'm sorry. In my line of work, we tend to be vague. Okay, this is what we're talking about. A new life, new car, new house, plenty of money, and a safety net for Danny, including an education at a top-notch university when he's older. We guarantee his safety, Sikorsky grumbles. Guarantee? Absolutely. I haven't lost a soul in 30 years. Record spot clean better than the airlines, the agent snickers alone. But what exactly do you want Danny to do? Do you understand his particular situation? Fred presses persuasively. I believe so, Mr. Wilson. Okay, then tell me, Jenny interjects sharply. What exactly is Danny's special talent? Prove you're not one of the crowd. But if you can't tell us, you're out of here, she adds, pointing toward the back door.
That sets up the conflict that you must read or listen to believe you won't be disappointed. This book is available as an audiobook through Audible and in the iTunes Store. Information and links are on my website at narrationbygeorge.com/books. Scroll a short way down to the Action Adventure section to find the icon for this book, The Sixth Lobe. Click on that icon, you'll hear other samples there, and you'll get links for purchasing the book. You can communicate with me and comment on social media and by email. I'm Narration by George on Facebook. On Twitter, you'll find me at Narration by Geo, or you can email me through my website. Go to narrationbygeorge.com and click on the Contact Me link in the menu. Next week, I'll spend some time looking at the second book in this series, Born to Matter. We'll meet the adult Danny and follow his adventures as he seeks to right some wrongs. Join me then. In the meantime, share the blessing that God has shared with you. See you then.